Music from Ginger Millerman, song Fountain of Life. Good morning to you. Now about 14 minutes after the hour. A little slow getting started here. We're trying to make some new connections on David's new microphone here. And all of a sudden, we're not hearing David. But we're hearing Doug. Doug Greenwald joins us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, the senior teaching fellow at Preserving Bible Times. And we've been discoursing. Is that the right word, discoursing? Have we been discoursing? Does that apply, Doug?
Beats me, Henrietta, but we've been sure talking a lot.
We have been, about sheep and shepherding, and learning why that has relevance to us at all. It has a lot of relevance to how we read and interpret and understand Scripture. Doug, we're pleased to have you.
Before we dig into that, how are things going on your secessionist movement there to create?
The movement is gathering steam. Mainly because the weather's getting warm. We topped 90 degrees here in East Dakota yesterday.
Did you really?
Just astounding, yeah. In fact, if this keeps up, we may have to move the state north. I'm not sure. We're not used to that kind of thing here.
Well, I'm from the land of wiretaps and IRS audits here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're in a secessionist posture, if you're trying to secede, have you checked your wiretaps lately on your phones?
I don't know how to do that. How do you do that? You pick it up and look under it and see if there's a wiretap there? Is that what you do?
Well, first thing you listen for is a tap, 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 tap.
Oh, I see. Okay, you could be our director of security, too, in addition to our... We could use you here.
Well, I also have more bad news.
Uh-oh.
If you're going to go for a 501c3, forget it.
Oh, could a state be a 501c3?
Well, but your name, Broken Road, I mean, the word broken is a key word because it seems to imply you're criticizing the government.
It also speaks to David's microphone connection this morning. So see how well chosen that name is. Yeah, I think Minnesota will miss us eventually. They're going to come on their knees to us, come crying and say, come back, East Dakota, come back to where you belong.
I have a wonderful way to garner a ton of publicity quickly.
Okay, we can use that. Yep.
In your unicameral house, or you know, the two-camel house, or whatever those things are.
It's dromedary. We call it the dromedary.
Yeah, right. Two humps versus one. Mm-hmm. The first thing you want to do is repeal the law of gravity.
That sounds like a grave task to me.
Actually, the state of Kansas legislature in 1848, I'm told, actually did that. I assume that was whimsical, but that would get you a lot of attention, right? Because you can repeal the law of gravity, but gravity just keeps working, right?
Well, it may have been they just needed to float alone at the time.
But it would stand in such a contrast to your state of Minnesota, which has just repealed the law of marriage.
We've been dealing with that here. A lot of unhappy people with their noses out of joint, and I'm one of them, I think.
There's a wonderful parody there. I've thought about it for a long time, but I've never sat down to write it, about a group who really seriously wants to repeal the law of gravity and then make all the parallels with trying to repeal the inviolate law of marriage.
That's the modern technique, though, is if you don't like something, you change definitions. You don't change the law, really. You just change the way the words mean things. You change the definition to suit your purposes, which it just seems to be out of bounds. We lose all frame of reference then.
Well, it's not unlike what tends to happen when we read the Scripture sometimes, too. We take those words and give them new meanings.
We have. We have read into them. We've read them, seen blank spaces, and made up stuff to go in between. And that's happened for 200 years, at least in the church, maybe longer. I've been doing kind of a study on the 12 apostles here, and actually including James, brother of Jesus, and Paul and Barnabas and Mark, who was not one of the original 12, but an apostle nonetheless. And looking at the combination of legends and traditions interwoven into what scant history exists, it's really hard to determine what happened at all. We have so disguised the history.
And in certain situations, like the birth of Jesus around Christmas time, tradition actually has a stronger grip on us than the truth. And so that's what tends to happen over time. And that's why I love context. It tends to detox us from those sorts of leanings and those sorts of misunderstandings and gets us back or closer to the original meaning. And that's important because it's where we find the original meaning. Always intended by the Holy Spirit in a passage or a text is where we're going to find the transformational power. I think part of the reason we deal with significant amounts of anemia in the church these days is we're far removed from the original meaning of many of these important passages.
Well, that's true. And the more those blanks we can fill in from an authoritative point of view, that tends to make sense of things. A lot of the stuff we've injected between the parts that we understand to make up for what we don't know have simply confused the issue. And it's caused us to lose our bearings. Once you get the context in there, those pieces tend to go together smoothly, and you say, oh, that's what that is. Yeah, now it makes sense.
Now, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, tradition, culture, lack of understanding has created a lot of white spaces in our understanding, but fortunately, the dots are still there, and mm-hmm. we have to reconnect those dots.
Exactly, and that's why it's just a joy for us to have you here every Wednesday, because you really, really redirect us, and that enables us in the intervening days to go back to our Bibles and make a little more sense of things. And it's also nice, just so listeners know, there are podcasts of all of Doug's conversations with us. You can download them and listen to them at your leisure, or you can listen to them on the website at brokenroadradio.com. I think you'll find them of great value in your ongoing Bible studies, maybe even for your small group discussions as you get together with folks. David, you're sitting there. Do you have a microphone? No, you don't. Okay, he can hear us, but we can't hear him. So we will proceed nonetheless. Tell us, Doug, why we should care about shepherds and shepherding at all, other than Jesus makes a great many references to shepherds and sheep.
Well, and I would say that's the primary reason. If Jesus identifies himself as the good shepherd and laces his teaching and his interactions and his commentary with people and events and circumstances with his shepherd and sheep talk, it must be pretty significant. And also, it takes too long to develop, but part of what Jesus is invoking as his last statement on the cross, when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me, which is Psalm 22:1. It's a teaching technique called remez. It's a hearkening back to something that everyone knows to be true. And by hearkening back to Psalm 22:1, he is invoking all of Psalms 22, 23, and 24 as his final statement. I don't have time to develop that thought, obviously, in its totality. But even in his parting statement, as he's takes his last living breath on the cross, Jesus invokes Psalm 23. So yet another reason to pay attention to this sheep and shepherd psalm.
Now, there's a lot of just the daily activity of shepherds that we can learn from, that we can draw understanding from. Sheep folds and shepherds sleeping in the doorways to the sheep folds. Tell us, now I don't know if this was on your agenda tonight. I don't want to interrupt what you had planned, but a sheep fold itself, what is a sheep fold?
A sheepfold is a protected environment or a semi-protected environment, probably in two different ways. In southern Judea, you've got a lot of soft limestone formations coming up out of the ground, and it looks like somebody took a really big ice cream scoop and scooped half caves out of the sides of these protrusions of soft limestone. And so when you got half a cave, what the shepherd will do is take rocks, and if you've been in southern Judea, that's one thing they specialize in. Mm. They certainly have rocks. And they build a wall, sort of like a hedgerow wall, if you've ever been to England, just, you know, rocks piled up on each other, mm-hmm. about 18 inches wide, maybe 4 foot high. And so that partial wall would start where the half cave ends, and it would curve around to where the other part of the ice cream scoop is, leave about a 3 foot opening. And so the sheep would be protected in this semi-cave with this fence on the outer edge, if you will. And the doorway is where the shepherd would lie across it to protect his sheep. And much of the time, he would probably be sitting in the doorway playing his flute, his lute, or singing to his sheep while scanning the horizon for enemies. And we're a couple weeks away yet from talking about the enemies of the sheep, the fox and the hyenas and the lions. Some of those animals attack during the day, like the lions do, and some of them attack at night, like the wolves and hyenas do. And so they're in the sheepfold for protection from the foxes and the hyenas in the evening.
Now, you mentioned that the shepherd would sing, and I know Jesus talks about the sheep knowing the shepherd's voice. Do the sheep take comfort in that? Do they respond to the voice? Like, you know, if you have a dog, you get unconditional love, and they wait for you, they know you, they don't react the same to other people as they do to you. A sheep has something of that same nature then?
You covered two different aspects there. Let's talk about my sheep know my voice. Oftentimes, a shepherd and his flock of, say, 80 to 100 sheep is actually watching over the sheep of probably 6 to 8 family or clans from the village. A family who has 5 sheep is actually fairly well off. A clan who has 15 sheep is fairly well off. And so what they do is someone is designated, actually multiple people are designated, to oversee, let's say, the 100 sheep from your village. But when the particular family wants to call out their 5 sheep from, let's say, the sheepfold that contains all 100, that family member will walk into the doorway and say some words and call his sheep, and those 5 sheep that are part of that family know that voice, and they will separate themselves out from the other 95. So that's what Jesus is making reference there to, is my sheep know my voice. As the individual shepherds approach a communal flock, they will call out their own specific sheep just by voice recognition.
Now, is this a member of the family that kind of rotates as shepherd? I'm a little unclear as to how these sheep would spend enough time with their family to know that voice.
Well, the rotational thing is probably measured in years. So the older son would probably learn shepherding from his father and maybe walk with his father with the flock for several years. Mm-hmm. Then the next son would take over that job and do that for several years. And then the next son would take over that job. So the recognition changes over time, but we're not talking about weekly changes here. We're talking about multi-year changes as the father teaches each of his sons the intricacies of being a shepherd. And believe me, there are intricacies.
And each family then would derive the benefit of these sheep, whether it's wool or milk or in some cases meat.
Yeah, from their 5 sheep, mm-hmm. You know. But you see, when one of the sheep gets lost from a collection of 100, which is the village flock, which yes. contains 6 or 8 or 10 family flocks, that one sheep belongs to a family. And so if 5 sheep is your total earthly possession and one of them is lost, that's a 20% reduction in milk. Mm-hmm. In wool. It's a crisis. And so I think we miss this. When Jesus leaves the 99 sheep in the sheepfold, he does not leave them unprotected. No one shepherd deals with 100 sheep alone. There would always be multiple shepherds. But when he goes off to find the one sheep, it's a crisis for the family who actually owns that one sheep.
Let's talk about shepherds themselves for a while. We already covered the notion that they were among the lowest of the low in terms of the societal structure.
In the first century.
Scorned even. Unclean, not able to go to temple. Why was that?
Well, because they've committed crimes. And the crime is stealing, at least in some of the rabbinic interpretations. How do you steal? Well, when we talk about grass here shortly, you've got to roam far and wide to find grass for your flock in Israel. In southern Judea, you probably only have green grass for about 8 weeks in the late winter, early spring. You remember when David was sold off, when Joseph was put into a cistern up on a trade route, it was in northern Samaria, almost 80 miles away from Beersheba. In the south, where the family was hanging out, and later Hebron. So that gives you an idea of how far shepherds have to roam to find grass for their sheep. So Yeah, there's a lot of roaming that goes on here, and all of that is over terrain, some of which may be familiar, some of it may not be familiar. And there are dangers and issues lurking in every one of these micro ecosystems that the shepherd is moving his flock to. So, by definition, a shepherd and his flock is eating grass that he does not own. It's somebody else's grass. Somebody else owns that land. And in the rabbinic way of thinking, to be forgiven, you have to do retribution. Contrition is not good enough just to be sorry. And so how are you going to provide retribution to all the people whose land you ate grass upon if you're a simple poor farmer? And the answer is you can't do it. So therefore, some of the rabbis would reason, if you cannot do retribution, you can never be forgiven. And if you can never be forgiven, you can't go to temple. The whole system is kind of catch 22.
So they're the lowest of the low. They're perpetually unclean, almost like lepers. But their crime is different, is all.
Yes, and that course makes it just awesome and breathtaking that on the night of the birth of Jesus, it's these shepherds who get the good news first.
Well, there's another principle here, I'd say, in that God comes to us. God went and got his disciples. The normal course of events was disciples sought out a rabbi, as you have taught us.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a young man and his father would take a look at the area rabbis and say, that's the one we need to study under. Let's approach him and ask to be part of his study group. But in the case of Jesus and his apostles, he went to them. He selected them. It's much the same in the Christian faith as a whole, looking at the big picture from way up there at 30,000 feet, as you would say. God has come to us. In other faiths, other major faiths, it's usually the other way around. We're petitioning God to accept us. In our case, he's come to us.
Well, in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We learn two things there. He's not only our creator, but he's our initiator, because he is taking the initiative to reveal himself to us. So in the very first verse of the Bible, implicitly, God is the initiator, revealing himself to his people. Now, when we talk about Christmas Eve and the birth of Jesus on Christmas Day, there's another great initiative. It's a profound invasion of grace solely done by God's initiative himself. So I think wherever you look, you see God is the initiator. And if we look back on our own lives through the rearview mirror, in the inspiration of the Spirit, I think we can see time and time again that God has prompted us, nudged us, initiated us into new directions, new thoughts, new postures, new phases of remaking our lives and our hearts and our minds and our souls. And he will do that to our dying days.
Hmm.
But here, if you get back to the shepherd, you know, if you're a sheep, what's the one thing you dream about? Or do you think they would? If sheep could dream, what would they dream about?
If sheep could dream, probably green grass.
I would absolutely. Yeah. And you know why they would dream that? Because green grass is so hard to come by.
Rare.
In southern Israel, in Judea, the whole southern part of the country only gets 25% of the rainfall. The other 75% of the rain falls in the north. And yet 75% of the land mass of Israel is in the south. So you have the smallest amount of rain spread over the largest amount of acreage, so to speak. You probably will get rain for only 8 to 10 weeks a year. They're called the winter rains, the early, the mid, and the late winter rains. I usually like to take study trips there end of February, early March, when the winter rains are over and everything is verdant, green, just lush. And if the sheep could have that sort of environment all year round, they would be hunky-dory. But of course, they can't. Now, there's some other observations here. Just because something looks like green grass doesn't mean it's good to eat. There are poisonous grasses that grow on the slopes of this land. There are grasses, other types of grasses that grow that produce gaseous and nauseousness in sheep. There are other grasses that if you eat them, they provide you absolutely no nourishment whatsoever. And then there's good grass. And so one of the first things a shepherd has to learn a father shepherd has to teach his son is to how to recognize the good grass from all of the bad grass. And this is important because sheep are really dumb. They are really stupid. They are instinctive. They will do things. They get spooked easily, and they will eat bad grass as fast as they will eat good grass, and they have to be protected from all of these other kinds of grasses. So one of the things a shepherd has to be is almost a microecologist when it comes through to things that grow, so that he can lead his sheep to the green pastures that have good grass and avoid many, many pockets and areas that have grass that are not in the sheep's best interest. See any parallels?
Lots of parallels, but the question that's occurring to me now is, and you say the sheep are stupid, do they trust? Can you tell that a sheep trusts the shepherd, or does a sheep simply follow orders? You know, we can say that sheep are dependent on the shepherd for their well-being, but I can't get inside of a sheep's head here, and I'm trying to make the comparison to people, of course, being led and doing the right thing and knowing what the right thing is, what the safe thing is, what the proper thing is.
Well, there's a fusion of two thoughts there. Sheep are certainly led, and they love their shepherd. And when their shepherd takes his rod and bangs it on a rock to get their attention, they hear it, they turn, they follow. But sheep are so instinctively followers that they'll follow not just the shepherd, but the sheep in front of them. Hmm. And so if you have a sheep that's a little bit deviant, a little bit out of the mold, an outlier, if you will, who suddenly wants to decide to go his own way, he might have 30 sheep follow him immediately, because sheep just stick their head near the backside of the sheep in front of them and follow instinctively. There are stories of shepherds who are on fairly narrow sloped trails where one of the sheep just goes off the edge and falls into a deep pit, and 100 sheep follow him, because they're such instinctive followers, non-discerning, if you will. So those are the two issues that we deal with here. Sheep are instinctive followers, but they will often follow the wrong thing at the wrong time. And so the shepherd has to manage the sheep that tend to be wayward so that they will not allow other sheep to be wandered away with them. It's all part of the technique of being a shepherd to know which sheep are instinctive wanderers away, and you keep a special eye on them so they don't lead other sheep away as well. You have other kinds of problems in the flock. You have bully sheep who just love to push and other female sheep and young ewes out of the way. And so when a shepherd gets to a new feeding area on the slope of a hill, and the grass is good and it's plenteous, the bully sheep will immediately push the other sheep out of the way and want to get to that grass first and start to consume it. So another thing that the shepherd has to do is, when he approaches a new grazing area, is he gets close to his bully sheep and makes sure that they are kept away from that grass until the female sheep and the young ewes have had some time to eat on it. So there's a lot of discernment that goes on with the shepherd in leading, because he also knows he's got them sheep that lead in bad and wrong ways.
You know, the term follow like sheep is a negative term. It's pejorative.
Especially, well, it depends on who you're following.
Well, in our culture, too. But I mean, we think of ourselves as self-made, independent, do it myself, figure it out myself, fix it myself, make it right myself, and that's a virtue. But what we're saying is, in that culture, that might not be such a welcome trait.
Now, wandering off on your own will probably get you into a peck of trouble over time in this sheep shepherd analogy here, because sheep are never as discerning as the shepherd, never as make as good decisions. They're not as wise as the shepherd. They're not as discerning as the shepherd. And they get themselves into a peck of trouble. For example, if a sheep sees some really good grass that hasn't been eaten yet in a fairly dry pasture, acreage, and there's a thicket between him and that good grass, he'll ram his head into the thicket to try to get to that grass. Mm. So now he's stuck. And so the shepherd has to go back and extract him from the thicket because he instinctively and impulsively wanted to eat the grass that he quickly saw with no cognition of the issues, the dangers, the consequences of the move he was about to make.
So are we sheep?
In many, many ways. Hmm. Why do you think the Lord felt it necessary to give us his Holy Spirit to be imparted to us so that on a daily basis we actually have a shepherd with us?
And I'm thinking of the height difference now between a sheep and a shepherd. A sheep sees the world from, what, about 2.5 feet tall, maybe 3 feet tall?
No, actually 3 inches.
What? Oh.
90% of the day, a sheep has got its nose, basically within an inch of the ground. Mm-hmm. It's always looking down.
And so it seems it would make sense to trust someone who has a much longer view of things than you do.
Absolutely. And here's another thing a shepherd has to do. We sort of close out our discussion on grass here. Again, sheep have no discerning powers. If they get into wonderful acreage of lush green grass, they will eat and eat and eat and eat and eat all the way down to the roots and pull the roots out of the ground. And so the shepherd has to monitor the time, limit the time that sheep can be in lush pastures, because sheep will never know when to stop. And as they continue to graze down and down and down and down, they actually ruin the acreage, make it vulnerable to erosion, and there goes really good grazeland. So again, sheep, if they get into a good situation, never know when to stop. Will just gorge and gorge and gorge and actually ruin the grazing acreage that they're actually in. So that's another thing that the shepherd has to monitor, the amount of time that his sheep are kept in any one pasture, because he has to protect the pasture for the future as well. And so sometimes the flock will move from 4 or 5 different grazing areas in the course of a day just to protect each of those grazing areas from being overgrazed by non-discerning sheep.
Mm-hmm. Now, this knowledge of sheep and grass and all the other peripheral information about sheep would have been common knowledge to the folks that lived in the village, correct?
Absolutely. And so in the 23rd Psalm, when David said, "He makes me lie down in green pastures," wow, that phrase, green pastures, would have just come with a ton of insight and understanding that we frankly miss today.
Mm. Yes, we miss so much. Mm. And that's why you're a delight to have. You've got the wheels turning here. And we'll look forward to next week as well.
Well, I think the closeout here is to personalize this. Mm-hmm. If we really are like sheep, and Jesus says we are repeatedly, what analogies can we walk away from here? Do we really realize how undiscerning we can be when it comes to issues of danger? Are we really aware of how much we want to overgorge certain good things to the point that they become detrimental to us? All the parallels that we see with the sheep and the shepherd here are applicable to our human journey as well.
And is it any wonder that Jesus brought it up so often? And again, in his environment, people would have understood what he's talking about much more quickly and adroitly than we do. Hence, it behooves us to learn about sheep and shepherding and some of the intricacies of that. So
next time, let's talk about water, now that we've talked about grass.
Yeah, let's do that. Next on the agenda, water. Doug Greenwald is the Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times. They have a website. It's preservingbibletimes.org. I think you can even search for his PBT. They'll tend to turn up, too. Or you can simply link to them from brokenroadradio.com. And we suggest you pay them a visit, take a look at the resources that they have for you. Doug, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Music from Carolyn Ahrens.